You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, April 26, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, the executive editor of the American Prospect, David Dayan. On the accidental revolution. Also on the program today, U.S. reportedly to reopen the embassy, its embassy in Kyiv, in a bid to heighten U.S. involvement in the war. Meanwhile, it's the latest Ukraine funding package being developed. Senate may include food aid. Donald Trump told by Republicans, stay off the new Twitter. Meanwhile, a Trump-appointed judge says the government cannot exempt migrants from Title 42 prior to rescission in May. Texas Supreme Court halts an execution of a 53-year-old woman. Donald Trump found in contempt in the New York Attorney General inquiry, supposedly got to pay $10,000 a day. Doesn't deliver certain documents. Speaking of Trump, Ron DeSantis signs election crimes office bill into law in Florida. Beijing starts a lockdown to fight COVID. Paxlovid to become more widely available in this country, and yet another study, peer-reviewed, saying ivermectin useless for COVID. Lastly, Joe Biden to commute the sentences of 75 drug offenders. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. I am here solo today. Emma is taking a much deserved day off. I am here having walked to the office for the first time in 2.5 weeks. It was exhausting. I literally had to take a nap immediately, but I am here and I have tested negative for the first time this morning on an antigen test. I'm a little skeptical about it. I had tests that I took about a week ago that were really faint, but the two tests from that one box were both faint, and then the next day I was solid positive again. So when I go home, I'll take another test. But I have been told by everything I've read and by a doctor I've consulted with that it is highly unlikely that I am contagious at this point. I wear a mask wherever I go anyways, except for in this office. And, of course, I'm sitting across. We're all in the club now.
I'm back, too.
Yep. Bradley is also back. We're all within 90 days, right? Are you within 90 days?
Of having it? I got it around Christmas, so I think probably just over 90 days.
Okay. Well, that would be bad if I gave it to you, but I don't think I'm contagious
sure
at
I'm
this point.
I'm pretty sure I'm above it now.
All that said is great to be back. Thank you all for your indulgence. Just want to follow up on a phone call we got yesterday. We got a phone call from Brennan from Boston. And we clipped it, Jane McAlevey, who I thought would be a great resource for this person, among others, responded on Twitter. The question was, what...
we can play it if you want.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, let's play the audio.
I work for a social working company, and talking to a lot of my coworkers, a lot of them seem frustrated with the inability of our company to really promote itself to the state and the fact that we need more support for not only people who work here, because a lot of them are overworked but and also underpaid, but also like the people we need to help aren't getting the support they need in the state. Okay. If you followed a lot of what happened in like the Boston mayor race, there were some comments about like homelessness and how these people need to be in programs. Well,
okay, that's good there. All right. Well, the basic gist was that Brennan wanted to know like how he would go about organizing a union, perhaps for their shop. And in addition to sort of mentioning some other potential places that he could reach out, I said, you know, you could probably tweet at Jane McAlevey because she's always running workshops and she's one of the best labor organizers that that I've come across, and we've interviewed her multiple times. Mm-hmm. And we posted that clip. She responded. SEIU Local 509 is the union in Massachusetts for Brennan, social workers, private and public. Notes below from my most recent book. Key is to talk to rank and file members before selecting a union. Start your own. Also, see your see the Amazon labor union, form a group and register for our free course by May 3rd. So there it is. Well timed.
Yeah.
And she's great. You know, she responded very quickly to that. So always a great resource. Meanwhile, a lot of stuff involving Marjorie Taylor Greene today. In addition to the fact that there is a trove of texts to Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, Donald Trump's chief of staff, at the end of his term, she had texted him on January 6th and in the days following and before. We will get to that later. Also, I just want to just point out and make a point of this, and I will reiterate this later. She was sworn in days early. What, it was like a January 2nd. Is it when you get sworn in? Backbencher, theoretically, you know, we're told she's insignificant, right? She had the chief of staff to the president of the United States cell phone number within days of being sworn in. This is a freshman congressperson. And, you know, granted, now she's one of the top fundraisers for the Republicans. I could understand why that would happen at a time like now. But at that time, very interesting. In and of itself, it seems to me to be fairly unique. We'll ask about that later. But she was down at the border. Kevin McCarthy has pulled out all the stops to make sure that his the audio that came out about him dissing Donald Trump is being ignored. And so they head down to the border. The Biden administration is looking to rescind Title 42, which is an ancient statute about immediately ejecting immigrants or not even allowing them to go through the process of determining whether their refugee status or their immigrant status would be recognized by the United States on the grounds of health issues. Supposedly COVID, COVID-19 in this instance. As you know, if you are in America, we are convinced that there is no more COVID-19. It is completely irrelevant. And therefore, it seems absurd that we would keep immigrants out based upon that notion. As the COVID-19 that we have here, 35% rise in hospitalizations in New York State alone, is irrelevant. No reason to think that anyone else's COVID would be any more relevant. But so this is being rescinded in the third week of May. A judge, a Trump-appointed judge, just ruled that there cannot be any waivers to it that have been going on, apparently, at the border until without determining whether or not the Biden administration can rescind Title 42. Here is Marjorie Taylor Greene speaking at the border, talking about what will happen if Title 42 is repealed. This is essentially Donald Trump coming down the escalator and coming out and saying, you know, some of them are probably good people, but the rest are rapists.
The human suffering that has happened and is happening and will happen if Title 42 is repealed and lifted, and the amount of people that are expected to come across this border starts coming, this will bring human suffering, death, and crime like we have never seen. And we're already seeing it at numbers and elevated numbers that we've never witnessed before in our lives. Imagine being a mother and you
stop
can't,
for like, one moment. None of what she said is true. I mean, it's sort of hard to sort of nail down what she's saying, but the crime and human misery that we're seeing right now, we've seen before. In fact, I'm not even clear what crime and misery she's talking about. There is no indication that there is a jump in crime because of immigrants in this country or misery. If she's very concerned about the misery, she should probably talk to her fellow lawmakers who have allowed the one measure that lifted a third, half of children in this country out of poverty, who are in poverty, and has been rescinded. That, if they're worried about that type of human suffering, human suffering, she might want to look into that. But let's continue here.
Imagine being a mother and you can't let your children go play outside in the yard because there are people that you don't know who they are invading your country, coming across your property, and imagine what they could do to your kids. Imagine being a woman and you're just trying to get your groceries out of your car to carry them in the house, and you are faced with men who don't even belong in your carport, and that's where they are because they invaded our country.
I mean, they're back. They're back. Gearing up for it. More on that as the program continues. Meanwhile, first a word from our sponsor. I think I mentioned this before. I think we've done an ad for them before. We got this product years ago. Nutrafol. It is a natural holistic solution for men that promotes both healthier hair and whole body wellness. And I think at one point, like, you know, I was going to try and see if Michael wanted to use it or not. I can't remember. We had it in the office. And I don't remember if we ended up running any ads for it. And at one point, as I was cleaning out the office, I said this Nutrafol here. And Emma had said that she had a friend who had an illness. It caused her hair to fall out. And she took Nutrafol and had great results. And I was like, oh, I mean, you know, I don't even know if we ever ran those ads. And then just coincidentally, Nutrafol asked if they could run ads on the program. And based upon the experience that Emma's friend had had, I was like, sure. And it turns out that Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement. It's a supplement, and it's not, you know, it is more attuned to holistic health. It's about vitamins, and they have hair growth nutraceuticals, I guess, which go beyond genetics to multi-target the root causes of thinning hair, including stress, hormones, poor nutrition, metabolism, aging, lifestyle, like I say, through a whole body health solution. Each formula is physician formulated. They use natural patented technology, provides consistent and reliable results, and it does not compromise your sexual health. Studies have showed that men showed progressive improvement in hair growth and thickness after 3 and 6 months. So you can grow thicker, healthier hair and get free shipping on every order for $15 off. Now, go to Nutrafol.com/men. That's spelled Nutrafol.com/men with promo code MAJORITY. This is their best offer anywhere. It's only available to U.S. customers for a limited time. That's $15 off at Nutrafol.com. Spelled Nutrafol.com/men. Use the promo code MAJORITY. All right. Want to welcome back to the program the executive editor of The American Prospect, David Dayan. David, welcome back to the program.
Hi, are you flying solo today?
I am flying solo today. Emma is getting a well-deserved day off. I don't know that you, were aware, but I have been off for 2 weeks. I got a little bit of the COVID.
Oh.
And this is my first day back into the studio.
Well, you look great.
Well, thank you, David. That's very sweet. That's very sweet of you. But while I was on my forced vacation.
Mm-hmm.
I saw your piece, Accidental Revolution. I figured I would love to discuss this with you. Well, let me ask you one question before we get into that. This is completely off topic.
Why not?
You may or may not know. I was just reading through, you know, some of those text messages to Mark Meadows, which are pretty hilarious, actually, around January 6th. Was it weird that Marjorie Taylor Greene, 4 days after being sworn in as a freshman congressperson, has the cell phone number for the chief of staff of the president?
I mean, it's not like she was, you know, I mean, it was pretty well known she was going to be a congressman from the moment she won the primary. So it's not like you show up at orientation.
Right.
3 days before, and she obviously had.
Do all Congress
She was pretty well known as someone who was, on the MAGA right, well before being sworn in. So yeah,
all right.
I mean, certainly possible.
It struck me as impressive. Like I feel like
she's an impressive person.
Thank you. I appreciate that. All right. So let's move on to your piece of Accidental Revolution. I want to go through, there's a lot of it that starting with, you know, where we are in terms of the outlook for the Democrats, 2022, 2024, 2026. broadly speaking, there's not a lot of positive things to look at the moment, at least in terms of when we look at, control of the government.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly been, a really despair filled vibe, which is, I think, somewhat the steady state of Democrats in America, but I think at this point there's some reason for that despair. I mean, you see the very low approval ratings, bad polling on the generic ballot, and it's hard to find a path. Although, you know, it's early, but it at this moment, if the election were held today, there would not be a Democratic majority in the House and probably not in the Senate. And then you just sort of extend that forward. The 2024 Senate map is really tough for Democrats. It's the 2018 map, which in a year where Democrats, you know, really broke through, they lost, you know, a couple seats in the Senate. And even those who remain are people like John Tester and Joe Manchin and Sherrod Brown and, you know, people in very tough races. And there's almost no difficult races on the Republican side. So you look at that, you look at where Biden's approval ratings are at. Obviously, projecting into 2024 right now is kind of a fool's errand, but if you carry that all forward and you look at the structural inequities in Democratic politics and just our electoral system, you can plausibly play out, many people have plausibly played out this scenario of a filibuster-proof majority for Republicans in 2024 with a Republican president, and no longer the kinds of Republicans that stifled progress in the 2016 to 2020 era, people like McCain, like Corker, like, you know, the sort of keepers of the flame of sort of moderate-ish Republicanism.
I also, you mentioned the there is a sort of what you call a Democratic politics being structurally moribund. Let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, one thing that just struck me this week too, as I was looking at this, that I don't know is necessarily related to that, but it seems somewhat problematic. Joe Manchin's approval rating in West Virginia is up. Like, whatever he's been doing, cutting off material benefits to a state that is I believe the poorest in the country, has helped his approval rating.
He stopped the Democratic agenda, and that's a very Republican state. I mean, I don't see that being that big a deal for Democrats writ large. You're talking about a state Trump won by 40 points. Yeah, of course they like, you know, a senator that was, you know, high profile, the main impediment to any kind of Democratic agenda. So, yeah, of course. Well, that makes sense.
It is. When you put it that way, in terms of like he is running against the brand of the Democrats,
yeah,
which I think it ties into the sort of the problem that the Democrats have in their leadership's inability to sort of transcend that on some level.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Democratic problems, I think, are pretty multivariate. They've lost the ability to speak outside of a pretty narrow base centered in the big cities. They have really been completely obliterated in rural America. They're starting to lose ground among Latino voters in particular, which is probably the biggest near-term problem for Democratic majorities of anything. And that's not implicated in West Virginia, but it's implicated in a lot of places around the country. And then when I said structurally moribund, I mean, I'm really talking about sort of the policy agenda that we had this situation with Build Back Better where all these sort of siloed groups were decided that they could capitalize on this moment in time. Nothing was prioritized by leadership, and the policymaking apparatus itself, which a couple stories from people like Matt Brunig have talked about, is really damaged. There's kind of this groupthink. Nobody wants to criticize one another on a really simple policy level, so you get this real difficulty, not just to build the coalition to get the votes that you need, but a difficulty in actually producing good policy. So it's a multivariate problem. There are electoral issues. There are policy issues. There are, issues of political will, I guess, because there's this whole other agenda out there that has nothing to do with legislation that is being moved in very slow fashion. So that's kind of the very cheery state of Democratic politics right now.
I just want to dig into that sort of like that problem of having that sort of laundry list, because I remember when the House voted, I guess it was following 2018 on the House. I feel like there was a couple of bills that were big laundry list, messaging bills that were massive failures in terms of the messaging, because there was like 43 messages being sent at the same time, yeah, and none of them stuck with people. Are we seeing legislation like that, right? Where you have, and you know, we had talked at one point as like a sort of, I guess, as a retreat position, being okay, instead of doing 30 things for 18 months, I'm just, you know, pulling out numbers, mm-hmm, 30 things for 18 months and hope that they'll get renewed. How about doing 5 things that are permanent, essentially? I mean, that type of dynamic. Do we see that the former piece of legislation as a function of the House leadership essentially saying, how do I placate the various fiefdoms that exist within Congress, within the Democratic caucus? So I need the chair of the Energy Committee, the chair of the Health and Human Services Committee. I need all these chairs to maintain my power as leader in the House and my party discipline. So I've got to give them all a little something, something in this bill that goes forward. And then what happens is the bill is, we can't sell it to the American public because there are 43 messages in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a few things going on. And before anyone throws their computer into the wall, this is actually a hopeful piece that we're actually talking about.
I want to start with the
attack. We're starting with the misery, but there actually is a silver lining here, so bear with us. But I think there are a few things going on. One is what you just talked about, the need to placate all factions of the party and all power centers of the party. So you dole out these pieces to each committee chair. The other thing is something that happens outside of Congress, and this is where a lot of policy generation happens. Not a lot of policy generation happens inside Congress, but outside Congress, there are these groups that form what I understand are called tables, where they bring all these stakeholders together at one table and throw together all the best ideas for a particular very broad topic. And then all those ideas get smushed into the bill and then handed over as, these are our priorities that we want to see in a bill. I mean, the For the People Act is the result of exactly that process. And it was hard to explain because there are 50 things in it. The third dynamic here, and this is very specific to something like Build Back Better, is that you have a budget reconciliation process that only allows one bill a year to go through with 50 Democratic votes. And otherwise, you're trying to argue with Republicans that this is in their interest. And it's very difficult to get buy-in, particularly on major kind of, the kinds of items that people want to see from the Republican Party. So then you end up having by necessity to stuff things into one bill because that's the only bill leaving the station. So, everybody's trying to get a ticket on that train. And so that creates this messaging issue. It also creates, just suboptimal policy. I mean, once you throw all these things together, then you have budgetary constraints because the way that budget reconciliation works, it has to be revenue neutral outside a 10-year window. And that ends up creating this what Manchin, I guess, is called gimmickry, where you have the bill, have a particular program go for 6 years or 3 years or 2 years because you want to have it sunset before it goes outside that budget window. There are all sorts of complications that go into a process where you can only pass one big bill a year. And obviously ending the filibuster would do away with that. But the same person that's carping about the compromises that have to be made under budget reconciliation is the guy who won't sign off on ending the filibuster, and that's Joe Manchin. So, there are just a host of problems here from the way that policy ideas are generated all the way to the way that they have to be enacted under the current system.
Okay, so that's the bad news. But the good news is that there were in some respects some unintended consequences that came out of the big COVID relief bill, the American Rescue Plan, $1.9 trillion passed in what I think it was March of 2020.
Well, I mean, they're intended and unintended.
Right.
So the intended part is that the reason that we passed a big bill in March of 2021 was in many ways because there was an attempt to rectify the mistakes of the past. So the 2009 stimulus comes out. It's underweight. It's not big enough to make a serious change in the curve on unemployment. And it creates a very long jobless recovery that saps away at Democratic majorities because there's this high unemployment through 2010, through even 2012. Democrats were determined not to do that again. They're like, if we're going to err, we're going to err on the side of being too big this time rather than being too small. So they put together this $1.9 trillion bill that is designed to restore the level of unemployment that we had pre-pandemic in rapid succession. And let's say that it was wildly successful on that front. That the one thing that that bill has done has dropped unemployment from, I believe it was at 6.5% at the beginning of the Biden presidency to where it is today, which is 3.6%, actually lower, I believe, than it was in 2019. It's a remarkable achievement, and a lot of it can be chalked up to the relief, the help with purchasing power, all of the various things that were done with the American Rescue Plan. So that was intended. Like, it was very explicit. In fact, there's reporting from Jonathan Martin's book, and I'm forgetting who the co-author is on that. Alex Burns, I think. That Obama himself was very upset that he was being used as the what not to do model in that scenario. It was very explicit. I mean, Schumer and Biden, they were saying, we're not going
to
do that again.
Yes.
We've learned our lesson. We're not going to do that again. So this had the effect of improving the unemployment picture. If you talk to people like Larry Summers, they say it also had the effect of raising inflation. I actually don't think that's true. And we wrote a very long series of articles about how the supply chain is a much bigger factor than an overheating economy in the inflation picture.
But if I remember correctly, he also tweeted at you saying, why are you spending so much time talking about me when I want everybody else to be talking about me? Essentially.
He did. Indeed, he did. And I've never heard from him again, sadly. But the other consequence of this is the consequence that you normally see in a tight labor market. And that has manifested itself in the highest quit rate in the history of the record keeping for this going back 50 years. So we have 4 million plus people quitting every month, quitting their jobs, moving on to a better job, better position. But even more so, you see it in the breakthroughs that we've seen in the labor movement, which I really think are transformational. And I'm talking about the 28 Starbucks facilities so far that have been organized and have won their union election, with hundreds more on the way. I'm talking about the Amazon Labor Union's victory in Staten Island with another warehouse on Staten Island going through the election process right now, and about 50 other Amazon warehouses contacting the Amazon labor union saying, how can we organize our own workplaces? And that's not where it ends. We have the Apple store in Grand Central Station that has also sought a union election. And there are more examples of this. This is a breakthrough of the labor movement into places that it has not historically been. Restaurant, retail, and in the case of, and Amazon's kind of a sui generis case, but it's a warehouse sector where particularly you have, you know, the second largest employer in the United States and a large group of, you know, workers engaging in manual labor who are, you know, extremely diverse. So that is, I think, also a function of the American Rescue Plan and its goal of very tight labor markets. And I think that if you really step back and think about the potential, that's only potential right now. We don't even have a first contract from any of these groups, but the potential of 100,000 or 200,000 Starbucks workers organized, the potential of 500,000, 600,000 Amazon workers organized will have a serious political valence in the years to come. That's your argument.
And I want to talk about the political valence in a second. But is there something qualitatively different about these workers as opposed to, you know, we had a couple of years ago the Red State Rebellion where we had teachers, non-unionized teachers in many instances, striking and a lot of teacher strikes. You know,
that was also a time of low labor, of tight labor markets, by the way. That was 2018, 2019, when the unemployment rate was pretty low. That was a sector that was largely organized, but some of the states that were at issue did not have, unionized teaching workforce. But that was largely a workforce that was, you know, if you look over the aggregate of the entire country, 80% unionized, right. 70% unionized. We're talking about sectors that are 0% unionized that are moving extremely rapidly toward unionization. And if you think about the type of individual that is working at a Starbucks and how replicable that is to other firms in retail and restaurant, I think you're talking about a population of millions and millions of workers. We have a service-oriented economy, and the largest groups of workers that are at this moment, although it's changing, locked out of the collective bargaining system is the service sector.
Right.
And so Amazon in some ways reflects that as well. Right. I mean, they've just moved the retail into the warehouse. They're essentially retail workers that are working in the warehouse to send out your package, much in the way that someone working at Rite Aid, rings up your sale. But it is a different sector. And I think that's even more important because the other thing about Starbucks and Amazon is they're all over the country. And in the case of Amazon, they have to be all over the country because they promise 1 day or 2 day shipping to everybody in the United States. And it's physically impossible for them to do that without siting these warehouses close in some respect to every potential customer in the country. They can't just shut down a warehouse the way that Walmart, for example, did when there was a meat cutting operation in, I believe, Quebec that organized and they just shut it down. And they could do that because Walmart wasn't promising everyone in Quebec that they could get their meat at Walmart. But Amazon actually is promising that. They're promising that anybody who logs on to Amazon and has a Prime membership can get anything that they click on at that site within 24 to 48 hours. And it's impossible to do that if you're shutting down warehouses if they organize. So I guess they're in a pretty compromised position.
Similarly with Starbucks. I mean, you can close a Starbucks in downtown Worcester. But the fact of the matter is those people working there are similarly situated to the people in Newton or in Iowa, where it doesn't matter where it is. You cannot contain the contagion from the perspective
and what is the function of this? Like, why are these workplaces organizing now? I mean, part of it is that they figured out a model that really works. In the case of Amazon, organizing inside the factory with an independent union process.
We should also just say, Ryan Grimm had a good piece the other day,
the NLRB's decision.
The NLRB made it allowed that you could actually organize within the workplace there.
And that's definitely a factor. But also I would have to say that the fact that workers know that if they get fired or if the Starbucks shuts down because they organize, they could walk across the street and get another job because there are that many job openings.
Right.
It instills a measure of courage that allows you to engage in the very hard work of organizing. And historically, there is a correlation between tight labor markets and more labor organizing.
I feel like we're seeing that dynamic in nursing. There's been a fairly decent number of nursing strikes that have happened across the country because there is such an incredible demand right now for healthcare workers.
Right. So I mean, to sort of step out from that, having established that, yeah, the American Rescue Plan and the tight labor markets it helped create are a function in the flourishing. At least at a nascent level of the labor movement right now. What does that mean for politics? What does it mean that there might be a million or a couple million more new young people, largely young people, who are organized and interested in furthering this? The United States is kind of an outlier in the fact that it hasn't had a labor-led political party in history. There are certainly alliances between the labor movement and the Democratic Party historically, but they're pretty loose. There's a reason that you hear the Labor Party, not just in Britain, but in many countries in the industrialized world, and they are labor-led parties. And if you are one that believes that the current state of the Democratic Party is in an impossible situation where it's out of touch, it is speaking to a narrower and narrower base, then the rise of a new force in politics that either will create its own party or potentially help take over the Democratic Party is exactly the kind of transformation that you would hope to see. And so I can't help but think that this is a really positive development overall. And it's kind of, Democrats certainly got a lot of things wrong over the last 2 years, but they got this one thing right. And this one thing might be able to realign politics in some way, such that this hype about Republicans, becoming a working class party, would ring a little hollow.
Right. I mean, the fact of the matter is, to the extent that there were failures of any Democratic politicians coming out in the context of the Amazon organizing. They showed up. Maybe they showed up late, but they showed up at one point. We were not seeing, you know, New York State Republicans show up at Staten Island in support of these people. I mean, there's, you know, there's a lot of Democrats that we wouldn't see show up there either. But to the extent that there are any politicians showing up, so what would be? So if your argument is that, it seems pretty sound to me that this is going to have an impact on our politics, because the idea is that there's no reason to think that it ends in Staten Island. There's no reason to think that it ends with the first, 30 or so Starbucks in the country. There's every reason to believe that this is going to continue. What are the benchmarks that we should be looking at, A, and B, what are the obstacles? Because if we do see, let's say, the Fed starting to tighten the monetary supply as a way of like, well, I mean, Alan Greenspan, I've looked for this. I know for a fact, though, he said it at a Senate hearing. Part of his job is to maintain a certain amount of worker insecurity because worker security ends up leading to these type of things. And so, and I imagine the Fed still has, certainly has that mandate on some level, theoretically, or at least, you know, somewhat submerged. So what happens if they start raising the interest rates and we start to, the labor market starting to slack?
Well, let me take that second and we'll start with, you know, sort of what the benchmarks are. But here's one point that I want to make. You know, right now, one of the reasons that we think that Democrats are kind of in a really difficult position is that they are split in their loyalties, their their orientation. They, in order to win the kind of support that they think they need to build a coalition, they need to, you know, hit up corporations for a lot of campaign donations. And the policy apparatus is largely driven by, you know, nonprofits and think tanks that are funded by foundations that are essentially rich people. And having a foundation-led kind of policy orientation is not one that's necessarily going to get you to a place where you do the kinds of things necessary for working people. That don't make the same people funding your apparatus uncomfortable. So I think there's value in a labor led, working people led, rather than a kind of organization led politics that we see right now, where the organization's popular constituency is a little hard to find. So that's what I think is the real value here, is that, and that's a throwback, right? That's a throwback to the New Deal era, where it was really led through a labor coalition, the kind of structures of New Deal liberalism. So that's
And also, you didn't have, I think there's some relevance too to the fact that the ALU is an independent new union, that there is not necessarily sort of like the problems that come with institutions that have ossified.
And I'm not saying that the ALU will or should be, you know, hacks for the Democratic Party. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that, much like the civil rights movement became an independent force within our politics, and moved the party that was most receptive to it in its direction, that is the kind of impact that this independent labor movement could have.
All right, let's talk about the Empire Striking Back here.
So yes, I think that's a serious concern, and it's why we should be informed about it now, of the ulterior or maybe primary goal of what we're seeing right now, which is this call for more and more rate hikes, you know, 50 basis points, 75 basis points, get interest rates up to break the back of inflation. And, you know, I have questioned in the past exactly what inflation would do to, for example, reduce the backlog of ships now in the Shanghai harbor,
right,
or to stop the spread of COVID. Like there are things that interest rates can do, and there are things interest rates can't do. And right now, in my view, inflation is being driven by factors that rising interest rates cannot affect.
And we can see this at the very least. The easiest way to see this is that inflation is happening across the globe, regardless of what the fiscal responses have been to COVID. And we're going to see, and we can.
I mean, factories in Shanghai have been shut for almost 4 weeks now, and this is one of the largest producing regions of the entire world, and that we're going to have shortages. Like, other factories are going to have to be shut down because the components aren't being made in Shanghai in that region. The finished goods aren't being made in that region, and they're going to, you know, to the extent their basic necessities, there are going to be shortages there, and it's going to raise prices. And there's nothing that the Fed can do about that.
But when the Fed raises interest rates,
then suddenly it becomes harder for businesses to finance investment. And if it becomes harder for businesses to finance investment, then they're not going to grow their factories. They're not going to increase. Hold on a second. Sorry. They're not going to increase the capacity of their production. If they're not going to do those capital expenditures, they're likely to not be able to employ more people. And to the extent that this all leads to a reduction in consumer spending because there are fewer people on the job, then that has its own kind of whipsaw effect as well. And so the goal is to make the cost of employing people higher in the hopes that you will, this is really the what they're talking about, in the hopes that more people will be thrown out of work. And if more people are thrown out of work, then they'll have less money to consume goods. And if they have less money to consume goods, then demand will fall and come in line with supply more, and that will lower inflation. I mean, that's the bank shot that they're looking for. And that bank shot is necessarily a bank shot that is supposed to loosen labor markets.
And it's also predicated on the idea that the inflation is a function of people having too much money, as opposed to supply being inhibited because of outside factors, i.e. COVID and supply chains, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right. So they are attempting a demand solution to a supply problem. And that demand solution will have effects on employment. Now, what I would say is that we're now already kind of down the road on these labor wins. And everyone who is situated at a Starbucks, at an Amazon, has seen a model for this to be able to work. So, yes, it is going to be harder if more people are thrown off the job and there's a larger reserve army of the unemployed, potential scabs, et cetera. But it may be a little too late. The genie might be out of the bottle. So I'm not convinced that that's just sort of the death knell of this movement, but it will absolutely make it harder if the Fed continues with this very aggressive monetary tightening.
Well, I mean, hope springs eternal, I guess. But it certainly feels like the genie is out of the bottle. And I think it's, you know, a lot of times this is about expectations that get developed amongst people, and also being inspired and realizing, like, oh, this is possible. They won in Staten Island. There's no reason why we can't win in, I don't know, Delaware or, you know, I'm just working my way west, I guess, and in Kentucky and Colorado and out to California, whatever, in Nebraska. Right. You people get the idea. All right. Let me just quickly touch on this one thing, too, about you wrote a piece today about inflation impacting the news. And it also in some ways, you know, ties into to Twitter on some level, too, because we could be seeing, you know, $46 billion or whatever it is. That's a lot of money to guys like you and I. And and if I was to, you know, there's only so much, you know, fun you can get out of buying a vanity project, like, you know, until things turn MySpace-y on it. And we could, you know, I mean, who knows? Elon Musk may have this idea of like, I'm going to start charging for this or whatever it is. But talk about the impact. The inflation is real insofar as the way it affects consumers right now. Right. And we're heading into an austerity, you know, I mean, when you raise the price of money, it's going to create sort of a more austerity in terms of this environment. So people are going to have less money, or less buying power. Right. There's Netflix has run into this problem where subscribers are starting to drop off. And really part of their problem too, is they also ran out of subscribers to sign up. They blew it in India. Yeah. Apparently was their big story. I think Amazon Prime went in there and undercut them. But
that's
we're
part
seeing-
of it. But I think the larger question here is, what does an inflation constrained environment do to subscription based services? And when I'm talking about those, I'm not just talking about Netflix and Amazon and you know, very large corporations, but I'm talking about, frankly, you and me. I'm talking about the fact that the great majority of news outlets, large and small, from the New York Times to a Substack, are predicated on gathering monthly subscriptions from readers and viewers, in your case. And when you're in a budget constrained environment, what is going to drop out? What are you going to drop out of your budget? Well, I got to have food. I got to have shelter. I got to have, you know, some other basic necessities. Yeah. Do I really need the Majority Report? Like, could I mean, that's obviously, you know, way up there. It takes a while before you get to there, but, do I really need this subscription service that I pay $6 a month for? And I'm trying to just hold on here, and I'm trying to you know, make sure that my standard of living is not degraded completely, but I might have to cut out a few things. And it seems to me that subscriptions are one of the big things that you're going to see some degradation on. And it's a problem that this has become a primary revenue source. Subscriptions have always been part of newspapers and magazines and what have you, even things like HBO. But in this day and age, it is the primary way in which people support themselves. Ads are funneled into Google and Facebook, and they have kind of a duopoly there, and you get less out of them if you're a news organization. Classified ads are over at Craigslist. And you know, go down the line of what the revenue sources are, and more there is a greater reliance on subscriptions as the model for journalism. And you know, I see this as a double-edged kind of situation. There was always a problem to me with the paywall as a gatekeeping function on information. So that segregated people into kind of an information class system where if you had enough money, you could get the real news. You could get the information that's really going on from the really high priced operations like Bloomberg and, you know, Politico Pro and some of these other tip sheets that are very, very expensive. if in the middle ground, if you had enough money to get a slightly smaller subscription, you could get New York Times information, Washington Post, et cetera. And if you had no ability to afford any of that, then you were kind of hoping to get bits and pieces from places like Twitter and Facebook, and where you're susceptible to a lot of noise to you know, reach that actual piece of information. So in my view, the paywall was kind of as big, if not a bigger problem than disinformation with respect to the media. And now you bring in the second part of this, which is that if you rely so much on the paywall, then you're more susceptible and more driven by spikes in the economy itself. That when it goes up, then you're doing well with your paywall and you're getting a lot of subscribers. And when things turn down, you're going to do really bad because it's not I can buy a paper today or tomorrow like it's 75 cents or 25 cents back in the day. It's I don't want to do this monthly subscription anymore. And I'm going to give up that piece of information. And if enough people do that, it has a real effect on the business.
And I would imagine it also exacerbates that problem of the stuff that gets behind the paywall has to be increasingly, you have to move more and more of your value behind the paywall to convince
Absolutely.
People
I mean,
to buy it.
Think about how mad people are about the fact that Mitch McConnell, the day after the January 6th riot, said this was exhilarating because now Trump is exposed and shown for the buffoon he is. And we didn't hear about that for 16 months. And that's because it was put into a book, right? It was a form of a paywall. It was put into a book. So they segregated that information. That's done on a daily basis with these various gatekeepers that are set up to segregate information. And there is an effect if you rely more and more on the paywall for your business to segregate more and more of that information. And I think it's dangerous.
But
more dangerous is that these things close. Because if suddenly you don't have enough money to sustain your business model, because in an inflation strapped environment, everyone's dropping their subscriptions, then it's the bigger problem.
People have to read the piece to find out what your solutions are, but they are.
I don't know that I have any.
Well. That was. But it's not behind the paywall. The solutions are not behind.
I mean, first of all, the prospects are never behind a paywall. Second of all, the solutions we know are, and we've heard about them for a long time, whether it's public funding or because, you know, the fourth estate is a critical part of democracy, or, you know, breaking up the Google Facebook ad duopoly so you can generate revenue that way. There are a lot of options for how to restore and revitalize news. They haven't been taken. And for that reason, I think we're going to be uniquely sensitive to pretty wild swings right now. And, maybe that spurs taking up some of these solutions. Maybe it doesn't.
David Dayan, executive editor of the non-paywalled American Prospect. You will notice every time you go over there, they put up a there's very often a. What do you call it? A splash page?
That would be a pop-up. Yeah, that you can click off.
It explicitly says this is not a paywall when you see that pop-up. Much appreciated. Always a pleasure, David Dayan. Thank you so much. We will put a link to those pieces at majority.fm.
Thanks a lot.
All right, folks. Now we will head into the paywall version of our program, which is admittedly, at times, a little leaky. We've actually been talking about for about 5 years, splitting it up. We may start to do that a little bit because of exactly that dynamic that David was talking about. So I think tomorrow we're going to be even experimenting with setting up at least a second stream for the fun half. More on that information later. But just a reminder, it is your support that keeps this program going. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, you get the free half, free of commercials. You also get the fun half. And a reminder, we have always, always had the policy here that if you do not have the resources to get the fun half, but you want it, you can email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com, put in the subject line fun half or something like that, or can I get the fun half? And we will work it out for you. So join themajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, majoritylive.com. If you want tickets to our Boston show, we are only 3 weeks out, ladies and gentlemen. Less. It's going to be an amazing show. I guarantee you, if you don't catch it, you're going to be bummed. So if you're anywhere in the locale of the Wilbur Theater on May 15th at 2 p.m. be there. We'll be a freaking co-op.
I'll be in a Celtics hat after the triumphant victory over the...
Whoa, big time.
I'm looking to make a purchase soon.
Big man.
I'll be wearing a Jets hat.
Good luck. Good luck, dude. Maybe you can get away with that in May. Maybe you can get away with that in May. Also, don't forget the Discord and also at majoritydiscord.com, the AM Quickie, ladies and gentlemen, amquickie.com. Get an email in your email box every morning, top political stories of the day from the perspective of people on the left. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, this weekend, Brian Box Brown, we talked about weed policy and monopolies and Curaleaf stealing wages. On Wednesday, Luke Savage to talk about his book, The Dead Center, and the sort of zombie centrism that we're forced to live with. So that's tomorrow night, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, let's bring to the program Nomi Const. Nomi, long time
no
see.
Get, like, music? Rolling in now? Uh-oh.
High on a hill was a lonely girl.
There we go.
There you go.
That's my song?
I don't know.
I think you got to think about that a little bit more. There we go. Love it. What's up? How?
Is there some type of like a crash cymbal on that or at the end?
And now we're turning into a 1960s vaudeville show. That's this show now. No.
60s?
50s. I don't know what 50s. I'm not your age. I don't. You were around back then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to vaudeville shows in the 60s.
Sam does not age. Little known secret.
What's happening on your show, Nomi?
So we have a really exciting week.
Where are you now?
I am at my parents' place.
Okay.
We had Greek Orthodox Easter this weekend, so we did some family stuff and. You know, you got to do that while you can. So,
no, I understand.
So I'm on a couch. That's where I am.
All right.
But luckily we have lights here, which is great. So I'm really excited about this because I have been obsessed with these guys, since they started their podcast and it's picking up steam. But if you guys know about the Conspirituality podcast, we have Matthew Remsky on tomorrow. This is a podcast dedicated to dissecting why a lot of the spiritual movement is moving to Trump. And like, it's based on sort of like get rich quick and like mind over matter stuff. But he is somebody who comes from the yoga movement and mindfulness movement. And yet is a leftist who really wants to kind of break through a lot of the, what we think. I mean, I think a lot of people, Alex Ebert from Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros has been doing a lot of work on this. Like, there's just this pipeline to radicalism, which starts, I think, in a really wholesome, empathetic place, but ends up in this, like, let's storm the Capitol place with the shaman, the
right.
January 6th shaman. So I'm really excited about that interview. That's tomorrow on our show at 8 p.m. And we also have David Dole on and Benjamin Dixon. So it's a pretty fun show. And then on Friday at 8 p.m., she's on a lot, but this time she's on to talk about her new book, Fight Like Hell, Kim Kelly, who is an incredible labor reporter. If you don't follow her already, and if you haven't had her on the show for her book, you really should, because she's just such a badass. She's like hardcore.
Well, we do have a book.
Yay,
we're ironing out the details, but we're booking
her. We're ironing out the details.
She's incredible. So very excited about that, too.
Great. All right. Well, we're going to you're going to join us in the fun half today.
Maybe.
We're going to take a quick break and see everybody in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Fun Hack.
Matt.
Who?
Fun Hack.
What is up, everyone?
Fun Hack.
Nomi Key.
You did it.
Fun Hack.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun Hack.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this,
7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start like.
Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-3501.
One half.
3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.4 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Oop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.